Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 308, being recorded on June 16th of the year 2001. It's basically going to be an updating of various stories and also a introduction or introductions in some cases of various stories. We're going to begin with an article from the New York Times of Wednesday, May 9th of the year 2001. This is an article by Frank Bruni, B-R-U-N-I, Dateline Washington, May 8th, headlined, Bush taps Cheney to study anti-terrorism steps. This, by the way, is a good one. It also, for people familiar with the history of counterterrorism or anti-terrorism, with the martial law contingency plans that were developed under the Reagan administration, under the auspices of George Bush, whose Defense Secretary Dick Cheney was, this should strike a very chilling note indeed. President Bush today acknowledged a growing concern about the nation's vulnerability to terrorist attacks, instructing Vice President Dick Cheney to head a special group to study the topic and creating a new office within the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Both Mr. Cheney's group and the new Office of National Preparedness will be devoted to making sure the country is ready, in particular, to recover from any use of weapons of mass destruction on American soil, a situation that would require coordination among federal agencies. Skipping down. It's an interesting question whether FEMA can herd all that cattle, said one expert, a former government official. He noted that it was smaller and less well-financed than many of the other agencies involved in counterterrorism. And, noting Dick Cheney's links to the Reagan and Bush administrations and the fact that the elder George Bush was basically in charge of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism, which resulted in the interagency governmental networks, the formation of the interagency governmental networks that were utilized in the Iran-Contra affair, and part of the counterterrorism or anti-terrorism planning that took place under the auspices of the elder George Bush when he was Vice President. Of course, he was former director of the CIA. Involved the formalization of martial law contingency plans as part of anti-terrorism measures. This is not a particularly encouraging development, particularly in light of the fact that the Bush administration itself has some very, very interesting connections indeed in numerous broadcasts, including For the Record 186, For the Record 256, and other programs. I noted that the family of Osama bin Laden may very well have put up a portion of the capital that went to start up Arbusto Energy, George II's first oil company. James R. Bath, who, according to Associates, was involved with the CIA and had been recruited by the elder George Bush, and who was the Texas business representative for the bin Laden family, put up 5% of the investment capital that went to start up Arbusto Energy, despite the fact that James R. Bath, I should say, had very little money of his own at the time, and that would strongly suggest that the money, at least part of the money that went to start up Arbusto Energy, came from James R. Bath's Saudi clients, and that would include the bin Laden family. That's the same family that Osama bin Laden, an anti-American terrorist who has been hiding out in Afghanistan under the auspices of the Taliban regime, well, that is the very same family. I would note that the genesis of Osama bin Laden goes back to the Afghan War, and initially bin Laden's efforts, as well as those of some of his associates, now fiercely and virulently anti-American, his efforts were initially subsidized by elements of the intelligence community associated with George Bush. I also noted in a number of broadcasts dealing with Campaign 2000 that at the very height of the campaign, this, by the way, would include for the aforementioned For the Record 256, at the height of the campaign, the destroyer USS Cole was bombed, and allegedly by the bin Laden organization. That was one of the factors that helped to make the Clinton administration and also Al Gore look weak. I would also note that at the height of the impeachment proceedings in 1998, the embassies were bombed in Africa by the bin Laden organization, and that placed Clinton sort of in a position of being attacked by the left for responding, albeit perhaps on bad intelligence, to the embassy bombings. On the other hand, if he had not responded to those embassy bombings, he would have been labeled weak, ineffective. You know, here was the loss of American lives with further threats against American property, and this would have been cited by the Republicans and the talking heads that support them in the media as proof that Clinton had to to resign. Noting Osama bin Laden family's connections to James R. Bath, James R. Bath's connections to Arbusto Energy and George Bush, noting the bin Laden connection to terrorist incidents and or military ventures that damaged the Democrats, including an adventure, including the ambush of some Army Rangers in Sudan in 1993, that military commitment itself having been begun by the elder George Bush, and U.S. officials, U.S. prosecutors maintain that bin Laden's forces were involved in that, although others dispute that, and noting also the bin Laden connection, the apparent bin Laden connection to the bombing of the USS Cole at the height of the campaign, consider the following. This is a column by Robert Scheer that was carried in the L.A. Times on Tuesday, May 22nd of the year 2001. It's headlined, Bush's Faustian Deal with the Taliban, and it reads in part as follows. Enslave your girls and women, harbor anti-U.S. terrorists, destroy every vestige of civilization in your homeland, and the Bush administration will embrace you. All that matters is that you line up as an ally in the drug war, the only international cause that this nation still takes seriously. That's the message sent with the recent gift of $43 million to the Taliban rulers of Afghanistan, the most virulent, anti-American violators of human rights in the world today. The gift, announced last Thursday by Secretary of State Colin Powell, in addition to other recent aid, makes the U.S. the main sponsor of the Taliban and rewards that rogue regime, unquote, for declaring that opium growing is against the will of God. So, too, by the Taliban's estimation, are most human activities, but it's the ban on drugs that catches this administration's attention. Never mind that Osama bin Laden still operates the leading anti-American terror operation from his base in Afghanistan, from which, among other crimes, he launched two bloody attacks on American embassies in Africa in 1998. Sadly, the Bush administration is cozying up to the Taliban regime at a time when the United Nations, at U.S. insistence, imposes sanctions on Afghanistan because the Kabul government will not turn over bin Laden. Well, a cynic, in this case myself, might suggest, or an informed cynic might suggest that perhaps that money to the Taliban was something of a payoff by the Bush administration to bin Laden. In effect, saying, good work, Osama. Thanks for blowing up the coal and keeping the heat on the Democrats and Bill Clinton. I would note in that context as well that bin Laden's father, Mohammed bin Laden, was very close to King Ibn Saud, the founder of Saudi Arabia, a close ally of the Third Reich and of Alan Dulles, who in turn was a very close ally of George W.'s predecessors, including Prescott Bush, his grandfather, and George Walker, his great-grandfather, both of them supporters of Hitler. In that very same issue of the L.A. Times, it was a very curious article in the style section in the City of Angels Society column by Ann O'Neill. Again, this is from the L.A. Times of May 22nd of the year 2001. This describes a gathering for the book publication of the spouse of Arnaud de Borgrave, last name D-E, capital B-O-R-C-H-G-R-A-V-E. De Borgrave, as a far-right-wing journalist with strong connections to the intelligence community, he was also on the staff of the Washington Times, owned by the Moon Organization, which is very close to the Bush administration. And this suggests some very interesting things. It remains to be seen what comes of this. This is by, again, from the City of Angels column by Ann O'Neill. It's called Supportive Spouse. Foreign correspondent Arnaud de Borgrave is our pick for jet-lagged husband of the week. He flew in from China for a posh party at the Truesdale Estates home of Kathy and Don Cole to celebrate publication of Villard, a biography of Civil War journalist and industrialist Henry Villard by his wife Alexandra Villard de Borgrave. Then, we're told, the intrepid journalist flew to Afghanistan to interview terrorist Osama bin Laden. Well, if true, that raises some very interesting questions. How did he have access to bin Laden with U.S. intelligence, at least in theory, hunting Osama bin Laden? How was Arnaud de Borgrave able to fly in and interview Osama bin Laden when he's supposedly out of the reach of U.S. intelligence and international justice? Again, that's an article that raises more questions than it answers. I wonder whether perhaps, again, the payoff or the money paid to the Taliban was not for their help in combating opium growing, but rather for their sheltering Osama bin Laden. In numerous broadcasts, including For the Record program number 19, we've dealt with the remarkable research of Ed Haslam, the author of the vitally important recent book, Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus, a study of an underground medical laboratory, or a story of an underground medical laboratory. That book was published in softcover by the Wordsworth Press and copyright 1995. It's a very complex and important work, and it entails research into not only the New Orleans milieu involved with the assassination of President Kennedy, but also research into not only medicine, but the fields of biological warfare and genetic engineering. Ed Haslam's vital research and very complex body of work is accessed again in For the Record program number 19, a 6 half-hour series interview with Ed Haslam, and in a number of follow-up broadcasts as well. Most recently, For the Record program number 269, titled Way Too Much Monkey Business. In Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus, Ed Haslam dealt with, again, not only research into biological warfare and the milieu of the Kennedy assassination, but specifically connected that milieu to research into the SV40, which is a cancer-causing monkey virus that contaminated the polio vaccine. In For the Record programs 198 and 199, we resumed with Ed Haslam's inquiry into the SV40. It's a virulently cancer-causing virus that, again, contaminated the polio vaccine for many years and that may very well have contaminated other vaccines for a number of years as well. Again, SV40 has been a focal point of a number of different broadcasts that I've done over the years. And in February of the year 2000, there was a very important article in the Atlantic Monthly. And that formed the basis of For the Record programs 198 and 199, including an entire reading of that article into the record. I got a call from Ed Haslam recently, and in the most recent issue of Penthouse magazine, specifically Penthouse of July of 2001, there's a follow-up article on Michele Carboni and the SV40 cancer-causing viral contaminant in the polio vaccine, and it's authored by the same two journalists who authored the article in the Atlantic Monthly's issue of February of 2000. Those authors are Debbie Bookchin, B-O-O-K-C-H-I-N, and Jim Schumacher, S-C-H-U-M-A-C-H. The article is about Michele Carboni. It's titled Cancer Warrior, and subtitled, Between 1954 and 1963, 98 million Americans were administered polio vaccine contaminated with a cancer-causing virus. Dr. Michele Carboni and other scientists have spent the past 6 years trying to discover the effects of this terrible mistake. Why are so many people trying to discredit him? And again, in For the Records 198 and 199, there's a detailed description of how the SV40 virus apparently causes cancer. And in the aforementioned For the Record program number 19, there is a detailed discussion of Ed's work into the SV40, an apparent soft tissue cancer epidemic that has stemmed from the contamination of the polio virus, and also of attempts at using a linear accelerator a particle accelerator to genetically alter the SV40 virus in order to create a vaccine against the cancers that figured to result from the contamination of the polio vaccine. Now, in this article from Penthouse, July of 2001, again also by Jim Schumacher and Debbie Bookchin, there is discussion of Howard Strickler, who is a doctor who did a very controversial study of SV40 and concluded, over the objections of many participants in his study, that there was no evidence that SV40 was involved with the formation of cancer. However, there are also indications not only that the National Cancer Institute itself was very conscious of their potential liability with regard to the SV40 contamination of the vaccine, but that also, this article also discloses that a recent closed-door consortium of the NCI in Bethesda, Maryland, to a considerable extent endorsed the research not only of Michele Carboni, but going even before that, Ed Haslam and people like Sarah Stewart and Bernice Eddy and Dr. Mary Sherman. And again, I realize this is a very tall glass to drink at one sitting. I refer listeners to Spitfire and to the remarkable research of Ed Haslam on the SV40. Now, dealing with Howard Strickler's very controversial studies, which dismissed the influence of SV40 in causing cancer, and the objections that were raised by participants in the study, the authors Bookchin and Shoemaker comment, in a letter to Strickler, one laboratory summed up the atmosphere this way, quote, "We feel that our comments about data interpretation are being dismissed and ignored. Your intransigence about the interpretation of the data and the conclusions of the study have forced us to admit that the collegiality and the scientific collaboration that was the basis of this study is very strained," unquote. Strickler's draft manuscripts were deemed so far off the mark that even an official of the FDA wrote a lengthy criticism. William Egan, Ph.D., head of the FDA's Office of Vaccines Research and Review, and a strong defender of the polio vaccine, said Strickler was wrong to say that the study cast doubt on previous positive SV40 findings. Quote, "I do not think that the paper should say that the presence of SV40 in human mesotheliomas," by the way, that's a rare cancer of the lung, "has remained controversial," unquote. Egan wrote to Strickler in February of 1999 after he had reviewed Strickler's draft report. Again quoting, "I personally think that the evidence for the presence of SV40 in these tumors is reasonably good," unquote. Strickler and Godert were so frustrated by the two dissenting laboratories' persistent refusal to endorse Strickler's conclusions that they considered publishing the study results without the lab's permission. Godert ran that plan past one of the top officials at the NCI, Deputy Director Alan Rabson, M.D. In a June 1999 email to Strickler, Godert reported that Rabson, quote, "agrees we should no longer negotiate, but should send it in," unquote. But publishing a study over the objections of some of the participants is regarded as highly suspect in the scientific world. The Godert email reveals he was well aware of the potential perils the NCI might face if it went ahead with publication. Godert wrote to Strickler that Rabson advised first checking with the NCI's Office of General Counsel, quote, listen to this, "to assure that we, the government, is unlikely to be sued," unquote. Among other concerns, Godert was worried about potential personal liability. And again, listen to the following. This indicates that these naysayers were, in fact, keenly aware of what was going on. Quote, "If there is legal action, how much can and will the Office of the General Counsel help us?" he wrote to Strickler and added, again quoting, "Is there any reason to think we need coverage from claims of misconduct?" Unquote. After months of disagreement, an outside mediator was brought in to rewrite the study results. After more haggling, that paper was submitted to the prestigious journal Cancer Research. It was rejected. Eventually, 2 years after the multi-lab endeavor was completed, a version of the paper not authored by Strickler was published in the same small journal that had published Strickler's earlier negative SV40 tumor study. The NVIC's Fisher says that she is disturbed that Strickler, who is on record as being unable to find SV40 and is not a molecular biologist, was designated as organizer of the study. But what would be most disturbing of all, she says, is if federal health officials use this study along with the earlier Strickler study to justify further delaying any serious response to SV40. According to Fisher, the reason for federal foot-dragging is obvious. Quote, clearly, she says, the government and the vaccine manufacturers are afraid of the enormous financial liability involved if it turns out that millions of people are carrying a cancer-causing monkey virus that they contracted through a government-mandated vaccine program. McLaughlin agrees. There's a conflict of interest here, he says. The government was on the bridge when the polio vaccine was created, tested, and approved. It ultimately is a government-sponsored product, unquote. Liability issues, he says, should not stall research that could save lives. Quote, I understand they have a duty not to alarm the public unduly, but they have an equally strong duty not to mislead the public, unquote. That is especially important, McLaughlin says, because of research that suggests that asbestos and SV40 might work together to cause mesothelioma in some cases. People in high-risk occupations for asbestos exposure, such as plumbing, carpentry, and electrical wiring, might choose to limit their asbestos exposure if they know they are SV40 positive. This past March, the NCI held a closed-door meeting in Bethesda, Maryland. federal officials invited some of the top SV40 researchers in the nation to present their newest data. The two-day workshop concluded with an agreement on a statement acknowledging that mounting evidence indicates SV40 is indeed circulating in the human population and can be associated with human tumors. The NCI's workshop acknowledgement couldn't have come at a better time. And then the article goes on to discuss researchers who are experimenting, who are proposing trials of vaccines. And I noted in the aforementioned Atlantic Monthly article from February of 2000 that there was an antisense RNA that had been tried out experimentally, and this is a genetically engineered vaccine, and it appears to be very effective in wiping out SV40. I can appreciate that this is a complex subject and that talking about viral contaminants, biological warfare, the milieu of the Kennedy assassination, and a cancer epidemic all in one fell swoop might seem a bit overreaching. And again, I refer interested listeners to the vital research of Ed Haslam. Again, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, the story of an underground medical laboratory, Wordsworth Press, softcover 95. There's an updated edition of that, and there are numerous interviews with Ed Haslam available from Spitfire. Time permitting, I will give you the address for Spitfire later in the program. This article, again, is titled Cancer Warrior. It's in the July 2001 issue of Penthouse Magazine. It's by Debbie Bookchin and Jim Schumacher, and it not only indicates awareness of liability on the part of NCI, but that a recent closed-door brainstorming session at Bethesda, Maryland, indicated that, yes, quite possibly, SV40 may be not only circulating in the human population, but is cancer-causing. The next item that we're going to deal with concerns a pharmaceutical magnate in Southern California whose firm and who himself has come under fire recently. And this is an individual whose own history is inextricably linked with some of the recent U.S. involvement in the Balkans and participation in the destabilization of the former Yugoslavia. And some of the information that I'm going to read was discussed in For the Record program number 157. This is from the business section of Thursday, May 31st of the year 2001. This is an article by Mark Ballon, B-A-L-L-O-N. It's headlined, Three Dissidents Win Seats on ICN Board. Dissident investors in ICN Pharmaceuticals Incorporated dealt a blow Wednesday to controversial chairman Milan Panic, P-A-N-I-C, by winning a shareholder vote to put three insurgents on its board, setting the stage for a quicker breakup of the Costa Mesa drug maker. The corporate setback may be the biggest the 71-year-old Panic has suffered since starting ICN in his garage in 1959. With his iron-willed leadership, he has fought through government investigations, sexual harassment accusations, and two attempts by unhappy shareholders to limit his power. Skipping down, Panic, who defected from communist Yugoslavia and returned after the fall of communism to serve briefly as its prime minister in the early 1990s, vowed to continue to play an important role at ICN. What's of interest to me about the story is not the particulars of the ICN controversy, but rather how Mr. Panic came to be the prime minister of Yugoslavia, or what was left of Yugoslavia during its destabilization. I'm going to read an excerpt from a paper called German and U.S. Involvement in the Balkans, A Careful Coincidence of National Policies, unquote. This is authored by T.W. Bill Carr, Associate Publisher, Defense and Foreign Affairs Publications in London, and it was presented at the Symposium on the Balkan War, Yugoslavia, Past and Present. By the way, I mistitled this when I excerpted this in For the Record number 293. The actual title of the paper is German and U.S. Involvement in the Balkans, A Careful Coincidence of National Policies, and it was a symposium titled Yugoslavia, Past and Present, not the paper. This article, this paper, by the way, was presented at a symposium on the Balkans War in Chicago on August 31st and September 1st of 1995, and it deals with Mr. Panic's tenure as the Prime Minister of Yugoslavia. T.W. Bill Carr writes, In July of 1992, with the blessing and backing of the U.S. State Department and an invitation from the Yugoslav leadership, a naturalized U.S. citizen, Milan Panic, returned to Belgrade. He had left Serbia in the early 1950s as a poor young man and carved out a multi-million-dollar pharmaceutical business empire in California. Milan Panic was therefore the embodiment of the American dream and a potent symbol for capitalism over communism. Accompanied by a host of U.S. advisors, his mission appeared to be that of peacemaker, with the Yugoslav leadership hoping that his presence in their capital would result in better relations with the U.S. and the lifting of U.N. sanctions. On July 14, 1992, while still a U.S. citizen, Mr. Panic was appointed as the first prime minister of the new Yugoslavia. Under U.S. law, citizens of the U.S. are not permitted to hold office in or participate in any foreign government. In the past, people even voting in a foreign election have lost their U.S. citizenship. Yet Milan Panic was allowed by the U.S. State Department to become the prime minister of Yugoslavia, a country on which the U.S. had been the prime mover in imposing U.N. sanctions. It can only be assumed, as subsequent events seem to confirm, that the State Department hoped Mr. Panic would displace, quote, communist, unquote, leader Mr. Milosevic, after which Mr. Panic would be in a strong position to terminate the Balkans conflict on U.S. and German terms and bring Yugoslavia under U.S. and German influence, German economic influence. On August 11, 1992, Mr. Panic made his first tentative move to sideline President Milosevic. Together with the then recently elected Yugoslav president, Mr. Dobrica Kosic, Prime Minister Panic met with Lord Owen and Cyrus Vance in Geneva. Following the meeting, a joint statement was issued on future Yugoslav relations with Croatia and Bosnia-Herzegovina. It varied somewhat with previous positions adopted by President Milosevic. On September 1st, Prime Minister Panic startled the Yugoslav population by stating during a Belgrade TV interview, "The world sees Mr. Milosevic as a man who does not keep his word," unquote. President Milosevic brought a vote of no confidence against Panic. On September 10, 1992, the Yugoslav foreign minister resigned his post during peace talks in Geneva, saying Mr. Panic was continuing to work against the interests of the Serbian people. Another vote of no confidence was brought against Mr. Panic in November, and though it failed by one vote in the upper chamber, it effectively crippled Mr. Panic's administration. That concludes the reading of this particular section and a discussion of Mr. Panic's role in the dissolving Yugoslavia. Certainly a very, very interesting situation in which he was maneuvered into that position. This basically, with the exception of the concluding formalities, concludes for the record number 308. The various programs that I've done and some that I've alluded to are available from a duplication service, both tape and CD duplication service, called Spitfire. Their regular mailing address is P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Their email address is mail@spitfirelist.com. And there is a list of and description of the various tapes available from Spitfire on the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. There will be a detailed and annotated description of For the Record program number 308 in the For the Record section by the time this program is aired on the member stations that carry the broadcast. Sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. They have two websites, one of which is wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y, and there's another longer URL as well. There are links to both of the WFMU websites in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, and the longer URL is listed there as well. This concludes For the Record program number 308. By the way, listeners can also email me at my home base station, KFJC-FM, in the South San Francisco Bay Area, at DEMORY@KFJC.org. They can also listen to the program that I do from 7 to 10 p.m. on Sunday night Pacific time on the KFJC website at KFJC.org. Look in the Transmissions and Public Affairs section. That concludes For the Record program number 308, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on June 16th of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.